Welcome to the TVaholic.com interview with John Rogers, writer, executive producer, and co-creator of TNT's Leverage. On June 23, 2009, I got a chance to talk with him on the set, along with Joseph Dilworth of PopCultureZoo.com. We spent about 25 minutes with him talking about the show, the cons, and his other projects.
And Mitnick comes in, because Kevin Mitnick is a buddy with Paula Robbins. So I'm sitting in the hotel bar with Kevin Mitnick and Will Wheaton watching Digital Dailies on my MacBook Air. I'm like, I'm in the future. I don't know how this occurred. This is maybe the geekiest. And Will and I had literally been talking about the fact he got Arcane Power 2, the Dungeons and Dragons book, that day. And I was pissed off at him that he'd gotten it before me. This is actually the geekiest moment in film history.
More dailies
projections. What's he doing these days?
Will's acting and he's writing. I mean, his books support him and pay the bills.
What about Kevin?
Kevin Mitnick, he's consulting. He's white hat acting now. So he goes, he writes books. But now he consults with security firms. And it's basically like, you know, we have a big corporation. Hack us. See how you do it. See how it works.
Nice.
So that's his job now, is to test their security.
Excellent.
So yeah, we use his books as references. And, you know. And Paula's, you know, Paula gets one of these. I mean, we tend to do really kiddie script stuff. We don't tend to show serious hacking because it's boring. So it requires like 10 hours waiting for someone to telnet in so you can get backdoor and serve access. So anything super obvious, ask Paula. We don't keep getting around much. But Paula's our main. So.
You guys use like, you know, OS's people would recognize, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's like, we did do one thing in the episode. I gave Will a netbook because that's what Mitnick says. Like, all the guys are using netbooks because it's $300. If somebody busts you, you literally throw it out the door and, you know, let it smash on the sidewalk, and then, you know, they're all done. You're just running your like a little thumbnail OS on like a flash drive or something. But, you know, and that's actually in the we got so many nice mail in the pilot. Because he made a point of saying the whole thing runs off a flash drive. Because the original thing was, Dean's like, well, why don't we show the hacking thing where it boots up his computer? I'm like, they don't do that anymore. It's just all the operating system's on here. Hack out with the data. You're done. You know. The fact we give him a computer is kind of a TV affectation we have to do, right, so people understand what his job is.
So my wife, when we watch stuff like that, always turns to me and goes, is that real? Yeah. I do tech support. And I'm like, yeah, actually, they got it right. Yeah. It's cool.
we try to. I mean, sometimes we change stuff. I was looking at notes from the network. There were two things. One, when he hacked the electronic locking system on the car. And they were like, that seems a little much. I said, do you want me to come over and do it? Because I made them. I will show you. And the other one was when Parker had the little credit card reader on her thigh.
Right.
He said, that one looks a little small. I'm like, actually, it's a little big. I've got the real one on my desk. I bought for $200 on eBay, and it's too small to photograph. We had to gack up a bigger one.
Wow.
So we did a fun one, 206. We did a fun thing with the thumb reader. You know, in the season finale last year, we did the thing with just reading the print. And then we said, well, we want to do that again, but we want to do the great thing Bruce Schneier did when he was testing I can't remember when he did it. He was testing a TSA thing. He was making a point of, like, thumbprints, because it's the active capacitance reader where it can tell if it's a human thumb.
Right.
But what most people don't know is gummy bears have the same resistance as human flesh. So literally what you do is you take, like, a gummy bear and you put the print on it, and it will fool this insanely expensive thumbprint reader.
Awesome. That's great.
So we wound up using that in 206. So, yeah, we try to the real stuff gives you better material. You know, there's a million times we've gone, you know, we wouldn't come up with stuff if we didn't know how certain cons work. Like the plot of this one is kind of based on the Mona Lisa. When the Mona Lisa disappeared in 1911, it was arranged to be stolen by a con man. And what he did is, after it disappeared, actually a workman just walked out of the museum with it. He made 6 perfect forgeries and sold them all on the black market. Each person telling them, I'm selling you the Mona Lisa, you can never show anyone,
right, but
you own the Mona Lisa. And he made a fortune, and then he was only caught when he tried to unload the real one because he was so scared and freaked out by hauling around this masterpiece.
Right.
He was finally caught. And so any con we come up with, a lot of times they're general based on like our knowledge of cons now after a year and a half of breaking them and researching them and putting them up on the board. But a lot of them just comes out of like famous crimes. When the Antwerp diamond heist article appeared in Wired, literally the next day, every writer comes like, mine! I'm like, no, no. Every single one of them had the issue. Like, no, I'm not mine! They're like, no, we'll break it up, we'll figure out who's due, and there's an episode coming up. But, you know, new heist shit. I mean, we so parsed through everything that exists. They were so excited by new stuff. But that's the thing. They, you know, they fooled the greatest diamond heist in history. They fooled the motion sensors by with hairspray. You know, it's just bad.
It's lack little things.
Yeah. Bad lack security. So we do what we can.
So you do that at the top of every season. You just write, research a bunch of cons, or does it?
No. Now we've got like a working vocabulary. It was kind of cool. Paul came in at the end of last year. And sat in the room and break an episode because we had him in to consult or something. And he said, you know, we're throwing around like, okay, here's the book, here's the stall. Okay, we're going to run this version of the big store. He said, you guys are now a fully functioning crime crew. So you can actually do this for a living. This is how actual con crews work. Because what we do is we take a bad guy, we take a crime. Like, okay, we really want to go after Madoff. We have the situation where he's trapped in his house. You know, we know we're sort of in the house. Because remember, Bernie Madoff was mailing jewelry out of his house.
Right.
So what are this guy's vulnerabilities? What does his ego want? What does he want? What does family want? What are the rules by which you can get him out of there? Now we build the crime. What are the built around those vulnerabilities? So the episodes work better when they're built around us actually approaching it like a real crime crew. That it gives it us an internal logic. And then what happens is we come up with our own problems, like what could go wrong here, what could go wrong there, what could go wrong there. And also, what's the most fun you can have in this location? What's the most fun you can have? Because unlike a lot of one-hours, the jokes are important to us. I mean, I think the whole reason it's gotten the fairly strong fan base that it has for a first season cable show, to be honest, is the fact people found it unexpectedly funny. And that is the only occasional argument we'll have with the network where it's like, this episode's a little too funny. And I went, you know what? No one has ever stopped watching a show because it made them laugh. This made me unexpectedly laugh. I'm out of here.
Exactly.
It just doesn't happen. So, you know, with that, then you sort of build on that. Some episodes start with the villain. Some episodes start with the victim. You know, there was actually an article about a mill closing up here that was in the Oregonian like 2 weeks ago, a couple days ago, and I sent it down, and they said, oh, yeah, we can work with this. We have an idea that's built on this sort of thing. It's a process of accretion. You know, whatever, everyone comes in with something that kind of, sometimes it's in an arena. You know, the Wonder Twins, the two of the writers, Glenn and Reader, came in last year. I called them the Wonder Twins, if I had it, I'm sorry. They said, horse racing. We really do horse racing. We're really interested in Glenn, who's actually a horse racing fan. We think that world's interesting. I said, well, go research it for a week and come back. They came back. It's like, this is how horses is all built around bloodlines. It's all built around, you know, the horse's value is what's related to. This is how they're marked. It's interesting because we use the electronic chip and we got some emails going like, no, no, it's a lip tattoo. But people don't understand. It's like, it used to be.
Right.
Like, now it's this. And sometimes you actually pay a fictional price for being ahead of the curve.
Right.
Yeah. But it was great. That was a perfect example because I wanted to do The Lost Heir, Anastasia. Like, you claim to be the lost heir of the royal family, something like that. Well, there's no way in modern society to kind of jam that in. And then they came back from that research and said all horses are based on their bloodlines. They're like royal families. And we literally went,
perfect.
Boom. And we run the Anastasia, the Lost Heir scam, a classic scam of the 20s and 30s, but built around a horse instead of a girl.
Okay.
And so that was only the fact we had done all this research and had it kind of off the board that we were able to glue stuff together. You know, and sometimes it's just stuff we want to see them do. You know, Tim had at one point done like a goofy voice. We were hanging out and he was doing like a bad magician. He's like, behold! And he sort of screwed around and we went, you know, I really want to see Tim do the bad magician. So we wound up with a show where they basically take over like a corporate show. They're breaking into the upstairs while they're doing the horrible yearly corporate, you know, those things, right? The horrible yearly corporate end year. And he's the entertainment.
Nice.
So, you know, and so, yeah. And then there's the character stuff you want to do with the actor. Yeah. It's any the stories come from like five different directions.
Well, I think the humor works really well because it's not like, hey, everyone, look, a laugh. I mean, it'll be artisans walking by and quips a line.
Yeah.
And half the time you might not catch it, but if you do, it's like, that was really funny.
Well, that's the good thing is they know the characters well enough now that I can put them in situations, or the writing staff can put them in situations. And, you know, we'll usually script out lines, but we know they're going to add something.
Right.
You know, there's a lovely little bit where in the second episode of the season, or the third, depending on broadcast order, Parker was in an air band. He was just trying to do something really, really difficult. And of course, because of the mechanics of the script, we were like, fuck, I'm so focused on that. And then when you watch the dailies, Beth has like a full range of facial expressions. And when she does it, she's like, she comes up with a little victory dance. And it's, I couldn't have written that in a million years. So you have to, in second season, you trust the actors. If you give them a funny bit, they'll do it. If you give them a straight bit, they'll find something funny. And you know, you'll have some choices. So, yeah, but no, we have a thing in the room. It's like, you know, good humor comes from conflict. Just a joke for sake of a joke doesn't work. A joke while something's going wrong is funny. A joke at the expense of something going wrong is funny. You know, a joke while they're trying to solve a problem is funny. Right. But, you know, just a joke for a joke just lays there.
Right. So
do you guys have an idea of where you want to go with the whole season? And then you go ahead and put these ideas in?
They're pushing it for Dean's Wrap. First season we definitely did. This season we did. You know, it's changed a bit. And I don't know whether we're going to publicize this or not, but, you know, as you can tell, Gina's status has somewhat changed this last season. She'll still be in the second half of the season, but a little lighter. And we'll bring in a character to kind of do the grips. That's a friend of Sophie's and owes her and gets us some new complications, a little new blood, and a little new arguments. And, you know, so it's actually not a bad thing. I want Nate to go. End of day, you know, I know what the 5 years is for Nate. And as we go, the other characters kind of lead us to where, you know. Elliot, for example, wound up being more of a peer of Nate than we kind of originally anticipated, so that relationship changed. Elliot and Chris and Aldous have a very brotherly relationship. They actually hang out here. They like go out together. Chris taught Aldous how to play guitar. They're literally like brothers.
Right.
And so that vibe, you can't help but see that in the show. And so, you know, you wind up writing to it. And the most fun we have is like, and here's where Elliot and Hardison bicker. And then, you know, we just come up with a bit, and they're just like, you know, they're kind of pissed off brothers who died for each other, but they're going to be cranky.
Right.
So that happens. But the Nate, and how you get Nate to where he goes, that can evolve. But Nate, no, it's like, last season, we knew where we wanted him at. This season, we know where we want him at. Third season, depending how one thing works out, we know where we want him at. I know where the last scene is for the 5 years. And I don't think you can do more than 5 years of a show like this. I really think we could keep the quality up. And we burn two crimes an episode, you know, and we're in different locations. We don't have a standing set. It's not like, you know, I have a friend in the closer, and we always joke about, he's like, oh, it's hard. I'm like, what's hard? Oh, no, the girl's dead. Did you do it? I want the truth. Bang, that's it. You're done. The show's over. I can write that in real time. Oh, where do you go? There's a dead girl. Now you're back on the precinct house. Now you're in the box. You're done. You know, we're in tunnels under Portland. We're taking over art museums. We built a plane on our stage. You know, we're down at the racetrack. It's madness. And, you know, and they laugh, and but it's true. I mean, you can't, because of the nature of the show, you burn through an enormous amount of ideas every episode. And so, you know, the shark, that's what TV is, it's a shark. So I think we get 5 good years on us, and then I don't think, you know, I don't think you could back up the money truck enough. I think everybody would be good.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's good.
Yeah. It's, and you want to move on with the other stuff, but for right now, it's great. But yeah, so I know where Nate's going. I know where Nate's ending up this year. But everything else kind of evolves.
I thought it was kind of interesting, Nate, towards the end of last year. I know, you know, you kind of ramped up the alcoholism a little bit. And Sophie and everyone were like, Nate, you have a problem. But it almost seemed like he couldn't properly think his way through the con or what they were doing unless he had a drink. It's like once he had a drink, he walked out.
Yeah, I mean, there's a joke, and the joke comes from my relationship with alcohol. There's a joke in the season finale where function the alcoholic.
Right.
Don't worry about the alcoholic and celebrate the functional.
Right.
And that's a little close to home. But yeah, I mean, and that's what's kind of interesting this year is he's trying to stop drinking. and we didn't want to do the whole tortured alcoholic. Right. That's just done. And what he's found is he can stop drinking. It's a struggle. But what he has done is traded one addiction for another. And there's actually a line last year. Like, we do plan this stuff out. There's a line last year where he's in the rehab episode. Right. He says, what about, you know, how do you know you want me to stop drinking? Maybe I'm more of a bastard when I'm sober. And what they're finding out this year is, yes, he's more of a bastard when he's sober. He's genuinely kind of scary and cool. And his addiction, you know, we all trade one addiction for another. His addiction this year is control. And, you know, as the course of the series last year, where it was like, geez, your drinking's kind of spinning out here. The course of the season this year is, geez, you know, you're kind of becoming about beating the other person. And so we'll see where that winds up. I mean, you know, I'm fairly sure hubris isn't a good thing in a character. You know, rarely do you put that in a protagonist and have it wind up well.
Right.
So, you know, we'll see how that winds up.
Was it necessary, do you think, at the end of the season to kind of break them up?
Yes.
To bring them back in order to show perhaps that they're all there for more than just the money.
Well, there are two reasons. We didn't know if we had a second season. Is that Red Ox, by the way?
Oh, boy.
Oh, nice. yeah, the clip's not right. Sorry, I'm a bag freak.
That's all right.
We didn't know if we had a second season. And I really wanted the idea that if there was never a second season of Leverage, that 13 episodes told a story and that they were different people at the end of it. And so really, we get this great thing, blow up the offices and break up the team, and then it's like, and literally, as soon as they could pick us up, they picked us up. Literally, like, you know, like, they had to wait until the final episode aired, and it's like, boom, you're back, and it's in the summer. Like,
okay.
No idea how to do this. We really didn't think about what that might occur. And the thing was, well, you know, we don't want him to come back and kind of pull somebody out of trouble, and then how do we do it? So we actually bring them back, and without spoiling it, in a way that has nothing to do with crime. It literally has to do with the family. That they've kind of this ad hoc, Frankie, ramshackle family that they have. That's why they originally reunite, and then things kind of occur. And so, yeah, I mean, that really, and we've said this before, so that's not going to say it. Last year was about Nate Ford holding together a team of thieves. This year is about the team of thieves holding onto Nate Ford. You know? It's really trying to show him that he needs his family as much as they needed that family last year.
Right. Wow, I was actually wondering about that. Is that going to be sort of like the last time we sort of see them really break up or go off?
No. And that's the thing is you should keep in mind at any point. And by the way, that's something that that'll be the plot line for the summer, the first half of the season. These are people who are in transition, and you know the happy ending for all of them is they stop doing this. So you know it's hard, and that is a struggle. All of them will be in some way, shape, or form somewhere along either redemption, the path to redemption, or a shallow grave at different points over the 5 years. And Nate, and what's kind of fun is Nate's our protagonist is the most likely to end up poorly.
Right.
He is bad in compulsive control. He is incredibly self-righteous. He's incredibly arrogant. He's obsessive as hell. And plainly, of the bunch of them, you can see him ending up worst. And it'll be interesting to see like whether that's why we wind up or not. But yeah, any one of this team member has a legitimate reason to bugger off. And I mean, you'll see the roster. If not change, you'll see the roster vary for different character reasons on that course of the show.
Yeah, well, Elliot has like a really good line in the first episode when they're at the bar about how being the good guy now, and he doesn't know what to do with that.
he's it's an interesting thing because Chris informs a lot of that. But oh, that's right, you guys have seen the screeners. So, and the bar that was really intentionally, we don't want to do the typical get them back together. We really want to do it based around a family beat. And that's the idea, is they're holding on to him now because they have a purpose, and then their purpose went away. And they're bad at it without him. He has the magic touch. He has the ability to like get the client's trust and get the, you know. And we definitely, over the course of the season, and probably in third season two, will imply that during that break, they probably, some of them tried to do this and didn't do it too well. But Elliot has a very specific moral center, and he's someone who's always seen it very transactional. You know, he doesn't just hit people. Elliot considers himself a negotiator who punches people when it's necessary. If it's not necessary to hit you, if you don't escalate that situation, he's never going to initiate the violence. But if you decide to make that choice, he wants to end it as quickly and efficiently as possible. And that line where he says, you know, it gets under your skin, it's unsettling because it adds a complication to his moral framework he neither wanted nor anticipated. And he needs the team to be able to kind of take care of that morality so he can focus on his job again. You know, and that's, and yeah, each one of them has found that they can't go back to their old life without this in a different way. And you'll notice none of them are happy in that scene. None of them are like, it's so great being a good guy. They're all genuinely annoyed that their former lifestyles are useless. And so, you know, and people ask, like, why do they continue to do this? And it's a challenge of companionship. Like, hanging out with the only other people who are as good as you are, these are their only peers. So they want that. And also, you know, end of day when Parker's like, just stealing stuff. I can steal anything, but, you know, stealing something for a reason, that's the challenge. Pulling it off and making sure there's a happy ending for someone else is 1,000 times tougher than just pulling it off. And they're at the point in their lives where they need that. And it's a mix of the addiction of the rush of that feeling and the realization that these are the only humans I can talk to, you know, who I play at my level. But that's also kind of, you'll see in the season finale, the summer season finale, and then in the third season, God willing, is, you know, there is a third season, we're going to start opening up the crime world. You know, these characters came from somewhere. We've established a fictional universe wherein people like Parker exist. Who are those other people? Who are the other slightly larger-than-life criminals and thieves that live in this other slightly larger-than-life crime world? You know, McMafia, the book McMafia is really source book for the third season if we go there. Yes, sir?
Okay.
We're good. So that's it. It's like, you know, they're not happy about being in this situation again, but they're happy that they found that the way to solve it is to be with each other.
I guess the only other
time. It's a show, really, if you think about it. It's like, so it's a protagonist who's really hateful and obsessive and an angry drunk and a bunch of people who don't actually want to be on the team.
Yeah, they don't want to be together, but they still can't help it.
Yeah.
So the only other question I had was, you got any more comic book work coming up anytime?
Well, it's tough because, you know, I had a great experience on Blue Beetle, but I don't really want to work in that sort of work-for-hire environment anymore. You know, it was a great experience, and they were great to me, but I saw the limits of work-for-hire and control of character. And so, I have a standing offer from pretty much everybody to do a title. It's just work. I mean, it's just time here. During hiatus, I think, I might try to do some web stuff. Cool. I really, really love webcomics as a distribution. I've had to know some webcomic guys. You know, I know Jerry and Mike from Penny Arcade. Will's really good friends with Scott Kurtz at PvP. Did you see that the guy who did the Flash animation page turning mechanism?
Yeah.
I've linked to it on my blog. I'll throw it up again. But I want to say Yvette Babach is a French guy, and he, instead of like trying to put a bunch of motion and shit in the comic frame, he used Flash to do layers to create the illusion of page turning, but also to lay panels on top of the page. Oh, so, and his philosophy is dead right, which is, you know, people trying to introduce motion stuff in comics, and that doesn't work. Your job with a comic is to read and look at the pictures. And so he is using the interface in a really smart way to just be the page turner, but on screen.
Nice.
And Flash scales, of course, up to whatever size browser you have. So it's just really interesting work. He uses the page space in a really interesting way. So I don't know if I'll actually work with him, but that's, when I saw that, I'm like, that's how I want to do webcomics.
Nice.
So I think if we do anything, it'll be a webcomic-based thing, or something like that.
Everybody's
going to Gwent
now.
You know what?
They're pretty fantastic.
They did. And Mark Waid's happy with them. But I'll tell you know how Ross started that company. You know, he was talking about starting a comic company. He was my producer on Mage and film producer, and I knew him and Andy Kosky. And we were hanging out literally with myself and Mark Waid and Mike Nelson and Andy. We were all talking about our attitude towards zombies. Like, why does everybody have a zombie story? And it's like, what is about that? You know? And I think zombies are about identity, and Mark thinks they're about death, and Mike thought they were about, you know, about new beginnings. And Ross said, that's an anthology. Different attitudes on the same subject actually gives me my anthology. So he put it together out of his freaking living room. I mean, really amazing. Found the artists. They did the, we scripted. He did the tips. They emailed him. He did everything through his email box. There was no physical boom company for the first like year and a half of that company's existence. He went, he found the printer in Korea. He met with the rep down in on the waterfront in LA, made sure they got the documents and got the shipping stuff back. And they're higher quality books than both DC and Marvel paper-wise and printing-wise. And he got an insanely cheap publication rate. And so he started publishing the company. And his thing was always like, I'm going to be the guy who says, Do whatever the hell you want, but you got to do it in 4 to 6 issues so I can issue a trade. But other than that,
it's good work.
And when you're somebody like Mark Waid or any of these creative guys, to hear that, to hear, like, you know, it's like when I did Blue Beetle. Oh, you got to do a Sinestro crossover. The whole point of Blue Beetle is we don't live in that world.
Right.
Well, we have to be part of the universe. We got to do the crossover.
Whatever crossover.
That's our life. And, like, the, you know, the Eclipse one actually was really good. The Sinestro one was really, like, just crammed into my plot in the middle of an arc. It kind of compressed 3 issues of stuff I was going to do into 1, you know, that I planned for year 3.
Right.
But, you know, to be able to do, to have that control, and if you sell it, if you market it, they get a piece, but otherwise you own it. You're not going to. And there, he, Ross, is a facilitator of creative people. And then, you know, the other brilliant insight he had was the Pixar stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we were at dinner, he's telling me, he's like, I'm in a bookstore, and in the children's section, and he was buying a gift for a nephew, I think, and he said, why are there no comic books in the kids section? That's where comic books belong. So he contacted Pixar and said, there, and that's what they do. So they have the only Pixar licensed properties. They have Mark Waid write The Incredibles. I mean, come on. I'm buying that.
Exactly.
I'm buying a 12-year-old. And they'll collect them in trades, and they'll go on the, you know, the book trade is really where comics is going. So, you know, it's tough. You want to stay local to distributors in that format, the floppies. He got really ahead of the curve on that. And to me, the next thing is digital distribution and finding a way not to change the way comics are done, but to just figure out a way to make them attractive on a big screen and make them, you know, dynamic and interesting. And if you back it into a book trade like Warren does with Freak Angel or something,
right? Right.
You know, but even that annoys me. I mean, I love Freak Angel, but the fact it's cup size, like page size,
yeah,
drives me crazy. Everyone on Earth is looking at a screen like this.
Right, right.
Why aren't we formatting like that now? Not for publishing. We can publish books that bind like that. I've seen it. It's, you know, it's not rocket science. But we just, you know, we're bound by that tradition of selling in those stores. And so, I don't know. We'll see. The webcomics, I think.
Cool. Fantastic. That's all I have.
Cool. Anything else?
That's it. Just gonna let you just go.
Yeah.
I love the show.
As do I. Fantastic show.